question of self-confidence, when we think about that self-confidence, that foundation is greatly rooted in the present, in the now. So how does that compare to what the general population, what the masses of Western thinkers might hold to be true? You've heard universally an overview of some of the points of view available in popular culture. And we know that, yes, indeed, there's been 2,000 years or more of a veil of the concepts of original sin, vicarious atonement, sempiternity, that veil has overlaid some of the mind powers, some of the points of view in use among the collective of humanity. We also, as was you just heard, we also have the ability to observe that there's a secular, a materialistic or scientific reaction to that point of view. There's a whole range. And when it comes to self-confidence, in that reaction to that 2,000-year process or veiling, we do see a tendency among some, or some many perhaps, to focus on the persona, to see self-confidence as pride, as self-esteem. We can observe that logic can build self-esteem and arrogance, a lofty sense of independence and separateness, an exhibition of selfishness to the nth degree. Among those who are more benign thinkers, that logic can root self-confidence in personal accomplishments, in self-assurance arising from an appreciation in the personality, in the persona, an appreciation of that unique blend of abilities or qualities. So we would like to turn for a moment to the common observation of self-confidence as it shows up in the childlike state. And we know that in the Voice of the Silence, we're invited to revisit the childlike state as students of theosophy. In the toddler, we see confidence as self-reliance, a feeling, an intuition, maybe even an instinct in the toddler, that one can rely on someone or something. There's a firm trust and a state of feeling that there's really certain truth. We see this in the toddler as they learn to sit, to crawl, to stand, to cruise along the edge of tabletops, and finally to walk and to run. And we can observe in the toddler state patience, courage, optimism, desire, will, a vibrant form of pure confidence beyond labels, beyond words, really. It's just an uprising of intuition and instinct involved together. So if we keep that reality that we can see of self-confidence, let's turn to the theosophical foundation for self-confidence. And the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is the first fundamental, and our invitation to consider the true nature of self. In fact, that's one of the bases for the declaration of ULT, isn't it? As an eternal ray of the absolute, as a ray that has all powers of great nature exhibited in potential within it, we see the self defined theosophically as spiritual man, as soul. We're aware, of course, of the limits in animal man in the lower aspects of soul. We're aware that there's instinct in the toddler that will hopefully eventually bloom into full intuition, as in a spiritualized man, a sense of perfectibility, a sense of potential. And the sages across time, across cultures, places, across all eras of time immemorial, have taught that their self, in all capital letters, this divine ray coming from the absolute, the deific force, if you will. There is a notion of self that the self-conscious entity can use as a basis, self with a capital S alone, kind of a half step of mind and spirit, sensing, observing, watching as daily life proceeds, as moment by moment we live in the present. And then we know, of course, the level of consciousness of self with all lowercase letters. Self is a basis of attitude, motive, point of view from the personality or persona. In that degree, in that array of development, we also can observe change and motive, if you will, from the selfish, profoundly particularized, the illusion of separateness from all else, through degrees of self-awareness or self-centeredness, until finally a state of selflessness can be accomplished. But even in that selflessness, we find a confidence, an impressed, intuition-based, fully driven force of spirit in matter, spirit above matter. In the voice of the silence, we have a teaching that says this: saith the great law, in order to become the knower of all self, that supreme level of self-confidence, that universal one self, if you will, thou hast first of self with a capital S to be the knower. So as thinkers, we need first to become the watchers, aware that there is an eternal point of view that can oversee moment by moment any of the experiences and events that karma may bring. And there's a process to reach the knowledge of the self with all capitals. Thou hast to give up the watchfulness to non-being. In other words, give up the lower aspects of self-consciousness and rest in the eternal, rest between the wings of the symbols of eternal age and divinity across time in the soul, in spirit. And so with patience, as a toddler would have, we know the second fundamental is a basis, a firm foundation for self-confidence in cycles and periodicity, cause and effect. We are told to trust in the law, absolute divine justice, compassionate, infinite opportunities to grow into full enlightenment through the course of lives, through the lives that we're using in our lower vehicles, for the lives all around us, every single point of consciousness in manifestation. The Gita invites us to raise the lower self by that watchful higher self, to act as seemeth best to thee. So we're invited in that cycle of periodicity, as events and experiences come to us, to use free will, to have the confidence that we can use that free will to choose as best we can, moment to moment, and that the true power, that highest, loftiest spiritual self-confidence, is in the pause where we can retreat from the persona, retreat from the event or the experience, and center ourselves in the spiritual observer. So we work fundamentally in evolution, independently, it would seem, but as dynamos who can impress and elevate all life if our desires, if our will, if our imagination, if our thought process is centered in the foundation for true self-reliance. Brave, confident, self-devised, self-fulfilled, with the intent, the growth into the ideal will come about. In many ways, in terms of evolution, as independent free-seeking thinkers, aren't we like the sailors who are in the ocean in a tiny sunfish sailboat? That sailor may be aware and experienced, may be skilled in the mechanics of the little tiny boat, and they may be very firm in a conviction that as sailors of their own fate, they have concentration. But true wisdom for that sailor in that tiny little boat is the self-knowledge that above and beyond what the persona can do, what the little boat can do, is something far more universal. There are the forces of great nature, the wind, the tides, the forces of other entities, perhaps even huge fish that might be under the ocean surface, the currents, the rain, all of these conditions that might come psychically in cycles extrinsically to the thinker, that sailor has to, through daily effort, remain a firm, mindful person, but flexible in the face of all changes that nature, that karma, might provide. So how do we do that in daily effort? How do we have a foundation of the true self-confidence to maintain a firm attitude in the face of all challenges? Well, we pursue the creation and maintenance of a clean, heartfelt source of motives. We imagine the ability we bring into reality, realize that there is true soul wisdom, and that that soul wisdom can impact and overcome any head learning that life may have engendered. That we can practice self-restraint and fearlessness moment by moment. That we can generate the notion and maintain the endeavor to make theosophy a true living power in life, moment by moment. So, ethics, applied eternal verities, morality, the effort, an ongoing effort to maintain awareness in the moment, to be present 24/7, that is the life's meditation. That is the dharma of the human state. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? How we identify ourselves, how we create the image of self, and how we maintain the infinite range of confidence is the creative power. Hypothetically, let's say that the universe speaks. as we become aware of day after day existence, and we begin to reflect on our use of motive and what were our reactions, we may begin to see patterns. And hypothetically, we may say, I had all those little opportunities to prevent panic, and I indulged in some of them. Then came a time when I finally had the ability to say, geez, I feel panic, but I'm not panic. Only perhaps hypothetically to have yet another event knock us right off our pins. And it seems like the persona, the lower personality, loses all control and becomes completely enmeshed in a state of panic in some event that might come about. So what's key? Key would be habitual, planned, seated periods of meditation. We can look to Patanjali, to the writings of Mr. Judge and letters that have helped me. We can sit for meditation and practice the shaving process. We can study ourself and our use of self-confidence without condemnation, just with an observation of what was, is, and what can be with the right use of thought and identification of self-confidence. But probably the most overriding, powerful effort that we can make, like that toddler, moment by moment, who takes on every effort without any coloration of, geez, I failed, I fell again. We can practice more mundane 24/7, but such powerful meditation in the life's meditation. The power is in the pause before we speak, before we act. We can count to 10 in all events. We can turn to breath work. We may even develop a little mantra for ourselves that can anchor us moment to moment and reestablish true self-confidence. In the Key to Theosophy, we read about will prayer and how that becomes such a powerful force moment to moment in a self-confident life. And ultimately, moment by moment, in the present, we can consider, how would the ideal human dynamo, the Mahatma, the master, use leisure time? How would that one design coping mechanisms, no matter what karma brings? And so, as the Gita tells us, we can choose wisely and with every confidence that each failure is a success as long as we look at the failure and then try again. So the panelists are sure that you came to this morning's meeting with your own observations on these ideas. MDW.
Yes. We have philosophies in the world, or religions, we should say, such as Buddhism, where the teachings of Buddha are all about compassion and about living a life of service and of renunciation. Would we consider a Buddha a theosophist?
We can try to approach that from some of the ideas brought out in the first talk. Along with the idea that there is a supreme being who is separate from us, there is also the notion that my belief in God is better than yours. My religion is better than yours. As a matter of fact, as an expression of my faith in that God and belief in that religion, I can forcibly try to convince you. And if I can't, I can harm or restrain or kill you in the service of that God. So we might say that those whose aspirations understand that true religion is that idea which unites human beings, does not divide, and therefore is based on an idea of a source of life which is one and everywhere, in everything, cannot be divided into my God and your God. Whoever holds to that, we might say, is a true theosophist. And works for theosophy, works for humanity, even if they don't even know those terms. And certainly the idea that the teachings of theosophy have had different names in different ages. So that, yes, we might say Buddha, Jesus, Krishna, Lao Tzu, Confucius, Moses, Muhammad, all these individuals in the philosophical understanding their original teachings refer to that oneness, that unity, and a life devoted to that, in honor of that unity of all.
What also comes to mind on that subject matter is that in the late 1800s, one of the original objects of the Theosophical Society founded by Blavatsky was comparative religions. And the reason was a very self-confident and hopeful foundation that as thinkers, we could look into as pure the original words as we could find from each one of the historical figures that were the founders that set up the philosophy that came to reform human thinking. And if we could study each of them and line them up and compare them as independent thinkers, intuitively, we would be able to see the patterns and be able to see the commonalities and therefore be able to find pure theosophy behind any of the dogma, ritual, passive kind of blind belief that might have come after one of these great founders. The other thing that comes to mind philosophically in terms of theosophy is that we're invited to, quote, look within, thou art Buddha. So that spiritual essence of each of these sages or masters or saintly ones or enlightened ones, each of them shares a commonality of spiritual nature with each of us. And in that oneness is the ultimate self-confidence. I think we have a chat. And this is the chat. We find the truth in unity. Anything that preaches separateness is not the truth. Amen to that.
We mentioned that there are ideas that nourish hope and those that don't. At some point, we're going to have to label them as some ideas are false and some ideas are true. We may hesitate to do that because every religion has its devotees as saying, well, my ideas are true and yours are false. So we might hesitate to boldly declare what is true and what is false. But if truth exists, and apparently people believe it does, then it must explain, it must be fair, it must be just, and it must be all-inclusive. It cannot separate. And since truth in religion is that which unites all, anything that teaches separateness in religion cannot be true from a religious point of view. As science looks at law, anything that violates or does not follow basic fundamental law of nature cannot be true. And as evolution, progress, development goes along with the idea that we are searching for truth, that truth exists and we have to develop to an understanding of it. Anything that does not teach the possibility, the ability of a human being to know truth within and through their own powers cannot be a true idea. So we have reasonable criteria to intuit and discern for ourselves, at least, what is true, what is false, and what we are going to use as a guideline for our actions.
MDW, unmute, please.
So is the guiding force in our lives our heart or our mind?
Uh-huh.
How we feel or how we think?
Well, I guess as we come into this incarnation as personalities, we reflect karmically in our external makeup all of the tendencies of past incarnations, don't we? And in those tendencies, in the East they would be called skandhas, we bring back into this incarnation strengths and weaknesses, lessons mastered, lessons to be learned. And each of us, we're like a kaleidoscope where white light has come into a prism that's moving, and we're radiance of all these beautiful colors and nuances of activities. So for some of us, the beginning point is the eye doctrine, the head doctrine, the ability to think and the ability to reason and the ability to seek and find the true eternal premises upon which logic can bloom. For others of us, as self-conscious entities, we karmically come back into incarnation having mastered all that, having used it, and ready and able and open to what's called the heart doctrine, able to discern intuitively without logic, direct cognition based on soul wisdom. So where's the starting point? Each of us is invited to bloom where we're planted, to sit in reflection, look at the personality with courage and compassion, gentle, kind observation, and to look at that starting point and then use it to spin, because ultimately saying we should be thinking with our heart, it's the heart doctrine that would be idealistic and our goal for perfectibility. But certainly the eye and the head doctrine are paths that can be used toward that final goal.
Well, very simply, the answer to the question, also both heart and mind are the source of our action. And as our heart or feeling nature more and personal, and so can our heart, our feeling nature, as was pointed out, and our thoughts can be universal. Our feeling can be in touch with the intuitive and the discerning part of our nature. Because it's interesting, they're truly life-changing realizations in our lives come to us in a flash, in a moment of heart inspiration. It's as though someone delivered unexpected a message. And it's not like it's all laid out. It's a feeling, it's a realization, it's an intuition, it's a direct perception. And it's an awakening, aha. And then if we have time, we can figure it out and reason it, and oh yeah, that makes sense. But Krishna says, this knowledge coupled with a realization of it. So it's not just head learning, but it's the soulful, insightful heart realization.
And therein is why these periodic seated periods of meditation are like the icing on the cake of the 24/7 mindfulness. If at the beginning of a day we set a tone as universal as and as idealistic as we can feel it in that moment, and then at the end of the day, sit for a compassionate self-study, a review, looking for the patterns. Where were my feelings? What were my reactions? What were the responses? Were they universal? Were they particular? The universe is speaking through our companions, through the events that come to us. It's all part of a giant jigsaw puzzle in some ways. So just as the puzzler might put together the general outline, so the student of theosophy puts together the fundamental principles as a framework and then begins to piece together the various experiences and efforts until finally the picture is complete. MHW, your hand was up and I spoke right over you. I'm sorry.
So it sounds as though from the two speakers, what we got out of both of the talks was the fact that we have to rely on ourselves. We have the self-responsibility leads to hope and self-confidence. And having, most of us have been brought up with the belief in an outside God, and we would guess that switching from an outside God who's going to make us all better, that and switching to an inward action would definitely take, I mean, the lessons that we're learning is how to totally rely on ourselves regarding karma and reincarnation, and that we know that we will have another chance, many chances to get it right. And we think just knowing that I can make my own decisions, that nobody else can do it for me, is very uplifting and gives one hope and self-confidence, knowing we can do this ourselves. Nobody else will do it.
That sense of responsibility, and I can, as long as it's not used as a weapon, as long as soul isn't beating the persona over the head with the continued, you're a poor, lowly sinner, you dingbat, look what you did or didn't do. That judgmentalism is a harboring effect for some who have been raised in a formal religion with the early teachings of a blind belief in an outside God. And we can judge, each one of us is invited to think about it. You know, in a time of stress, when karma brings an event that is out of the ordinary and seems to be a test. Is one of the first thoughts that come to mind in a flash, oh my God, what do I do now? If that kind of thinking is the first thing in mind, maybe even the first thing off the lips, then we have the basis, a strong foundation in which we can be self-confident, and look at that. If that was the knee-jerk reaction, what was the basis in thought for those words? And do we still want to hold with lessons learned early in life? Or how have we expanded the meaning of the word God and deity and deific essence and force? All of it is the basis of learning. And none of it can be condemned as long as our ultimate purpose is to learn, to grow, to be better able to help to teach others, to impress the lives that we use.
Just very briefly, in our first expression of the common definition of hope, we said that it is based on an expectation of favorable outcome. That word expectation is loaded when it comes to self-confidence and hope. If our expectation and our self-confidence and our hope is based on a favorable outcome, and that everything we do will have the results we personally desire, we cut ourselves off at the knees. We get in the very way of our hope and self-confidence. Because life is such that we act expecting certain results and they don't come. And so we begin to doubt our self-confidence. We begin to doubt karma. We begin to doubt our hope. But here, the expectation is not personal. It's not a desire for personal reward. Rather, it is a confidence, a hope in law, in evolution, in the process of our own nature, and ultimately an expectation of what we do will be of service to all, that will result in a favorable outcome for all and not our own personal circumstances.
Well, we've reached the end of our time, haven't we? please remember that you're invited to Zoom in for the Wednesday night class that will start promptly at 7:30. We're coming to the close of our study of Mr. William Q. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy. And please look for that invitation, as well as the one for Friday night, 5:15, for the Wadius study, for the round table. Have a great week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.